All right, so I'm here with Mr. X, keeping himself relatively anonymous, but this is someone that's, an avid researcher, a lot of background knowledge in various different topics, someone who's been following the channel for quite some time. And really, with the kind of things we've been discussing and something that he's brought to my attention is this idea of self-organizing plasmas, which is something we're going to get into. But yeah, if you wanted to just give yourself a maybe a little brief introduction, Mr. X.
Okay, I have been interested in the UFO concept ever since I was a 7-year-old child. My father had some very interesting experiences. We can go into that later if you want. And I remember hearing about the Roswell incident during one of the episodes of, I believe, In Search Of. It was a classic documentary series back in the day. And I started reading about it in books and I just became obsessed. And so I've been studying the UFO phenomenon ever since I was a kid, and also I have been studying related phenomena such as exotic technologies, cold fusion, LENR, a wide range of exotic technologies over the past 100 years that have basically emerged only to either be suppressed or forgotten. I've basically I spend night after night doing research. That's basically what I do.
One of the first things I wanted to ask, really, just to kind of get a basis on where you wanted to start this off with, is what's your kind of recommended field of research in regards to the UFO phenomena right now? Like, what would you consider to be the most important aspect that people should be looking into?
Well, as I have shared with you in the past, I'm pretty much a nuts and bolts researcher, although I'm very interested in the consciousness side of the UFO phenomenon. I do believe there are real craft that are physical craft with real physical beings visiting this planet that have crashed and have been recovered. And so I'm interested in how the technology works. And I believe that the self-organizing plasma phenomena that has went by many different names is really the key to how the technology works, how the technology of our own reverse engineered UFOs work, and also potentially it has a connection to the consciousness phenomena.
So, what exactly is a self-organizing plasma for those that aren't really 100% aware of this?
When it comes to self-organizing plasmas, I will really want to walk your listeners through a series of concepts, but just to give an introductory statement, imagine that you have a discharge tube and you have a cathode, which is negatively charged, and an anode, which is positively charged. Normally, let's say you have ordinary atmosphere in there, it's in a gaseous state. However, if you run an electrical current at a sufficient voltage through the chamber, you can create a plasma, which is charged particles. Electrons will separate from the neutral atoms, and you will end up with positive ions, and you will end up with free electrons. And what's interesting is, under certain circumstances, instead of these positive ions and electrons being randomly distributed within the chamber, they can organize into specific structures that have very unique properties. I think that's a good introductory statement before we get to soldiers and the EVO phenomena.
Right. Okay, cool. Yeah, because I still don't really fully understand the EVO phenomena, and I'm still trying to get to grips with self-organizing plasmas. So as much as you're educating my followers, you're educating me as well. So I want you to take the lead on where you think the best place to start with all of this would be.
Okay, well, I'll get started with Kenneth Radford Shoulders. He was a mostly self-educated, very successful engineer and inventor. He developed multiple technologies, so he had had a successful career before any of this. He was actually so successful that he was known as the father of vacuum microelectronics. And around 1980, he met with Hal Puthoff, Dr. Hal Puthoff, now of
Yep.
Kudasar Academy, that formerly worked for NIDS and that owns EarthTech, or the Austin Institute for Advanced Study. And he met with Putoff, and he decided with Putoff to start investigating basically plasma phenomena. And he quickly discovered that if you have a spark discharge between, let's say, a sharpened cathode, you know, for example, in simplest terms, that could be a needle. And then you have an anode, which would be positively charged. And you run a current through it at a sufficient voltage, and you pulse it out of this plasma soup of ions and electrons and nanoparticles of metal that just exploded from the tip, because the tip is always damaged. An organized structure would emerge. Basically, the ions and electrons will start to circle each other and self-organize into a pattern rather than just being a random cloud. And so basically, it's these little balls. In reality, they're most likely either toroidal, donut-shaped, or spherical, or almost spheroidal, with just a little hole through the top and bottom. But, you know, for our purposes, we can call them little balls, or one name for them, what the Russians call them, or micro-ball lightning. And he discovered very quickly that they have a wide range of anomalous properties. First of all, he found out that they have a negative charge, at least on the exterior, and they behaved as kind of like a micro-scale electron, although they're really not, and they carry some positive ions in the interior. But they somehow, it appeared like they are balls of electrons resisting their mutual electrostatic repulsion. Because remember, two electrons or even two positive ions with the same charge should repulse. But no, these were staying together. They were remaining coherent. So that was the first anomaly. He also discovered that if he produced one of these EVOs, and EVO, let me say what that stands for. An EVO stands for an exotic vacuum object. That was the name he eventually gave these structures, these self-organizing plasma balls, or you could call them microball lightning. There's a whole range of names for them. Originally, he called them electrum validum, which was strong electron, but eventually he switched over to EVOs. Another anomaly he discovered was that when he basically made one slam into a target plate in front of the anode, he discovered they could produce transmutations and isotopic shifts. A nuclear transmutation is when one element turns into another element because it's a different number of protons. An isotopic shift is when it's the same element, the same number of protons, but a different number of neutrons. So he was producing these nuclear reactions, and he was able to measure that by running an analysis on the materials, on these ultra-pure materials, which he struck with these EVOs. He also realized, and this is what's very exciting, and we'll talk about this later, is these tiny little plasma balls were able to negate a huge portion, I mean just a massive portion, of their mass and inertia. Kind of like they had a warp bubble from Star Trek around them. Something about their structure was creating this warp field around them, or it seemed that way at least. So he could accelerate them to maybe up to a tenth of the speed of light with very, very, very little input energy. Basically, they were negating probably 99.999% of their mass and inertia. So that was a fascinating anomaly. And then when they slammed into a target plate, in addition to inducing transmutations and isotopic shifts, they could produce X-ray bursts. They could produce electromagnetic pulses, which would take out equipment even on another workbench. And that's really remarkable because, remember, these EVOs he were producing were tiny. He was working producing EVOs that were only a few microns in diameter. So these were right. Tiny little things, but they could create pulses that would actually disrupt equipment on other work desks behind him or several feet away. He was also able to learn how to control these EVOs. They loved to travel along dielectric interfaces between, let's say, aluminum oxide and atmosphere. And if he sent them down a groove, which they love to travel down grooves, if it was too small for the EVO, it would literally widen the groove, basically almost consuming the matter. And then at another location, just releasing it all in an atomized form. And so that was yet another anomaly. Also, he made little obstacle tracks for them. And he learned how to make them travel down grooves and then split apart, recombine into singular EVOs, make them jump over obstacles, do all kinds of things. He was also able to make them go into a black or invisible mode where they were basically unobservable, where they did not seem to be highly interactive with matter. But then, sometimes electromagnetically, he could make them reappear in what he called the white mode, in which they were highly interactive with matter. And of course, between black and white modes, there were, you know, hundreds of degrees between the two. And so he basically became obsessed with this. And for years, he studied this, collaborating with Bell Church, the founder of Church's Fried Chicken, who was the funder, and Harold Puthoff, who was, you know, the scientist of the group, and also his son, who helped out, who was like a lab assistant to him. Eventually, his collaboration with EarthTech, which was Harold Puthoff's company, originally he started this work in California, and then he moved to Texas when EarthTech was founded. But for some reason, we don't completely understand, his relationship with EarthTech sort of went south. We don't really know why. There's discussion about that. There's scuttlebutt, but no one really knows for 100% sure what happened. Another important thing to note about EVOs, and this is really critical what people have to realize. First of all, they are scalable. They exist on many different scales, from his tiny micro scale EVOs that were a few microns in his systems. You can even go down below that. For example, and we'll talk about this later, when you embrittle a material like a metal by loading it with hydrogen and you make it very, very brittle, when you damage the structure itself and then you crack it, it induces charge separation, which is also called fractoemission, and little EVOs can be generated. Or you can scale it up large and produce a macro scale or large scale EVO, for example, ball lightning. And do you have any questions so far?
Well, so it's your understanding, at least maybe to some degree, this is responsible for like the energy systems that we see in UFOs.
Absolutely. I think UFOs definitely utilize this. Now, obviously, there are many different types of UFOs that have been seen throughout the history of humanity. The UFO phenomena is not only a recent phenomena. There have been UFO sightings for hundreds or thousands of years. If you look back in history, if you look at the works of Jacques Vallée, you will see there's been UFO sightings forever. And I'm not saying all UFOs utilize the exact same propulsion system. However, I believe the self-organizing plasma phenomena is key to many of their propulsion and power systems.
I was going to say, what do you think about Foo Fighters? Because that sounds kind of almost like a plasma on its own.
Well, there could be many explanations for Foo Fighters. Again, since due to the UFO cover-up, we don't have access to crash recoveries, and we don't have access to any Foo Fighters that were actually captured, because I've read of a mission, I forgot the name, it might have been Admiral Doolittle, I'm not 100% sure on that, who actually was sent on a mission to investigate them, and I'm not sure what he discovered or not, but, you know, they may have actually captured one, we don't know, but I think some Foo Fighters could have been, you know, something like ball lightning. It could have had, some of them could have had a natural explanation. However, there's others that seem definitely not to be natural, that were actual solid metal sphere-like structures that were following aircraft. So there were multiple types of Foo Fighters. Some of them are probably not even called Foo Fighters. There were all kinds of things observed. But I believe that both the natural ones and the actual craft or drones, they both had something to do with this self-organizing plasma phenomena.
So in regards to kind of a research and development endeavor going on with self-organizing plasmas, Project Sapphire, right?
Well, Sapphire is one of the companies today that are utilizing this self-organizing plasma phenomena. But before we get into them, I want to mention that EVOs have been at the heart, in my opinion, of almost every exotic energy system for the past 100 years. There have been numerous different technologies that emerged and that were either suppressed or forgotten, or either the inventor basically in some cases get what I call inventor syndrome, and they do themselves in by becoming greedy or money hungry or even go insane or start dabbling in criminal activity. A lot of inventors, when they develop something really revolutionary, at least historically, they end up not doing themselves any favors. But a short list, there's many more of systems that utilized EVOs in one way or another, could include Thomas Henry Moray's various discharge tube systems that produced, you know, over unity energy. There was Joseph Papp's noble gas engine. There's also, you know, an HHO or Brown's gas systems. EVOs are involved. We can talk about that later if you would like. Then, of course, there's Alexander Chernetsky's self-generating discharge tube that actually Puthoff and his team went to Russia to investigate, and it seemed like it worked. And then, of course, there's Paulo Correa's pulsed abnormal glow discharge device, and there's probably a dozen others. And there's been many different systems that utilize the EVO phenomenon, because there's many different ways to produce EVOs. For example, in these cavitating bubble systems, every time you have a bubble and it collapses, there's a tiny little, because of charge separation during bubble collapse, there's a tiny little EVO produced. And if you tune these systems appropriately, you can get excess energy out. And cold fusion systems, both classical electrolytic and gas loading systems, where you're trying to push hydrogen or deuterium into metal, like I mentioned before, you're actually damaging the crystalline lattice of the metal while you're loading the hydrogen in. And what happens is that little fractures take place in the crystalline structure. And when that happens, there are little EVOs produced. And so that's another way that EVOs have been involved in exotic technology. So this is not a new thing. I mean, everybody knows about Nikola Tesla. Like I mentioned before, his original Tesla coils utilized a spark gap. And in this spark gap, he would try to prevent it from becoming a true arc discharge. And that's critically important, because basically Nikola Tesla's spark gap was like a high-powered version of Kenneth Scholder's EVO generator. There's a direct analogy there. So this technology goes back a long ways. So any questions before we move on to the Sapphire project?
Yeah, well, I suppose what I'd like to gauge your opinion on why you think, if it's been around for such a long time, why you think it hasn't actually been utilized on a global scale yet?
Well, there's many answers for that. It's not simple. Like most things in this reality, there's not just one simple explanation. You know, part of it is I do believe that a lot of these inventors doom themselves because they realize they have an amazing technology that's worth trillions, and they start getting money hungry. They also start thinking everybody's out to steal their technology. And in some cases, people are trying to get their secrets. And they start making bad decisions. They start pushing away allies that are trying to help them. they start maybe doing illicit things to raise money. And I call it inventor syndrome. So basically, they're hurting themselves, and that happens frequently. Also, I do believe there are acts of suppression of these technologies. You know, in certain cases, for example, there have been these carburetors, which have been bought out by oil companies. These carburetors allegedly would allow cars to, you know, hit 100 miles per gallon. But the inventors were bought out. In other cases, patents have been seized. Because remember, this happens dozens and dozens of times every year. This is completely documented. There's a government website that shows how many times this happened every year. If you have a patent application and you submit it, and the government believes that they need this technology, or they believe it violates national security, or if it could be a risk, they can legally seize it. And this happens again and again and again. This is absolutely real. It's been proven. It's verified. There's no question about it.
Absolutely. And there's a famous case with Stanley Myers.
Yep. And his technology used the EVO phenomenon. But what I was going to get at is we don't know how many inventions that we've never even heard of had their patents seized. I mean, inventors have had their patents seized. Another way it's suppressed is, I think, the special access programs interfere in more creative ways. So they don't exactly seize the technology, but they can interfere with its production. For example, if you can look at Edwin V. Gray, he had multiple technologies that were roughly analogous to Nikola Tesla, where he was getting over-unity energy out of this motor he built that utilized a series of spark gaps. And basically, I believe the government stepped in and tried to claim that he was violating some SEC rules. And so they seized his lab, they seized his equipment, they seized his notes, then they took him to court and they tried to have his investors testify against him. But from what I have read, none of them would agree to testify against him. And some of them actually wanted to give him more money to help him. And so they ended up threatening him with many years in prison if he didn't cooperate. So he plea bargained to get some little tiny charge. And then years later, he started the research up again. And then not long after that, he was found mysteriously dead in his laboratory. So there's all kinds, and I'm not saying he was murdered. I'm not saying that at all, but we just don't know. And there's so many cases of inventors that have had mysterious things happen to them. And we cannot blame the special access programs directly, but it's just so mysterious how this happens. And I believe that with these truly exotic technologies, there are parties that do not want them to emerge because for many reasons, you know, both the oil companies and so forth, which I think is changing. They don't want these technologies to come to light. But also the parties and groups in charge of the UFO cover up do not want technologies to emerge that would lead directly to the same technologies they have been developing since the 60s.
What's your opinion on the before we jump into the Sapphire project, what's your opinion on the patents to come out, the Salvatore patents by the U.S. Navy?
In my opinion, and I do not believe this is intentional on the inventor, I tend to believe the inventor is being honest and those patents are sincere in that he firmly believes they would work. But my opinion, and take this with a grain of salt, and I'm not saying this is 100% factual, but my opinion, after all the research I've been doing in this field for a very long time, I will say it's armchair research. I don't have a laboratory. I don't do experiments. You know, I don't have the money for them. I don't have the facilities. I'm not qualified. I don't have the hands-on experience with laboratory equipment. But from everything I have studied, I personally believe the Navy is allowing him to submit these patent applications because they misdirect people towards. I'm not saying that his patents absolutely would not work. I'm saying I believe that UFO propulsion and basically like what the Sapphire Project is doing, which is you know, cheap, clean energy production, I think it's way, way simpler.
So this is a more complicated kind of longer trail of breadcrumbs to the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The basic concepts are in there. The basic ideas that introduce people to the idea of the zero-point energy field, introduce people to the concepts of modifying mass and inertia and gravity, they're in there. But it's a roundabout route. These systems are complicated. They would require a lot of money to reproduce in some cases. However, I believe that the real systems that have been built, the practical systems that have been around for a very long time in these unacknowledged special access programs are fundamentally simple. And that is the key secret they want to hide. Because
that it's just that easy.
Yes, because if the truth came out about which what we'll talk about in a little while, the Fluxliner ARV or alien reproduction vehicle, if the truth came out about how these self-organizing plasmas could be used to manipulate the fundamental forces of the universe, gravity, mass, inertia, all of this, then little puny countries, I mean tiny little third world countries, could throw anti-gravity vehicles together. It's not as simple as doing it in your garage, but if you have an up-to-date laboratory, which most countries have at least a few, have a laboratory and some competent engineers and scientists, you could make one. And instantly, these corporations like Lockheed would have hundreds of competitors with anti-gravity vehicles, which could go to the moon in hours or could go to Mars in a day or less. And they don't want that.
So can we kind of assume that, right, based on the idea that the U.S. government, at least, let alone other foreign governments, but the U.S. government at least has had a lot of knowledge on this for decades and has probably been doing a fair amount of research development like the ARV Fluxliner. Are you of the opinion that they are pretty much there is, a secret space force, a completely separate interstellar version of the U.S., you know, space force?
I will say this. I firmly believe that we have developed anti-gravity vehicles. And we're going to get to this later, too. Tom DeLonge of To the Stars Academy, he said specifically on Coast to Coast AM in 2016 that the TR-3B described in his book, Cigarette Machines, was indeed a real craft. His insiders, who we will identify later on in this interview, which were outed by WikiLeaks, told him that we had cracked anti-gravity. And yes, we have built vehicles. He laid that out there. I believe the Fluxliner is completely real. I believe the TR-3B is completely real. I believe we have many different anti-gravity vehicles. What I perhaps disagree with is that we have a huge fleet. I am of the opinion that we probably don't have a massive secret space force, you know, with battle cruisers, you know, and hundreds of different fighters and so forth, like in science.
Yeah.
I tend not to believe that.
In the have you read the Secret Machines books?
I have read the first one. I have not read the ones.
I'm halfway through the second one. The first one I really enjoyed, and like, so you do you kind of think that it's probably following a similar narrative, just in regards to the fact that they're mainly counter surveillance platforms that are used quite sparingly?
I would say there's probably different roles for different vehicles. I believe that they've probably built different vehicles for different purposes. You know, I would not be surprised at all if we had small scale and repeat small scale outposts on the moon, on Mars, or we have patrols flying around the solar system, but not a huge space force. I believe that we've had probably missions across the solar system when it comes to exploration or even spying on what the ETs are doing. Because you have to realize, too, with their telescopes, there could be a mile-long mothership, you know, in our outer solar system. And even with the Hubble telescope, we wouldn't be able to spot it.
Right.
And so one role for these craft would be to determine who's coming and going from our solar system. So there's many different roles that could be playing. I mean, this is just a little bit of a, I don't want to call it conspiratorial, but another role for this could be to help fund the special access programs. Because you have to realize the asteroid belt is like a treasure trove.
Right, and yeah.
They could send a craft to the asteroid belt, and they could easily find very small asteroids of precious metals that could be worth billions, or rare isotopes that could be worth a fortune. And in just, you know, a month's time of several missions back and forth, hey, they're funded for the next 5 years. So I'm not sure if that has happened or not. I'm just saying.
Yeah, this just some speculation, but.
Yes.
Well, a little bit of hope potentially for the public in terms of research endeavors is this Sapphire project. I put up they had a promotional video, which was really well done. I loved how they actually made the video. And it was because, to be honest, when you have these different scientific academies making things, sometimes they don't get the promotional value right. But it was really good to watch. And I put it up on my channel because I thought it was an interesting thing. But I hadn't put a lot of research into it. It seemed like a really interesting kind of like novel technology, exotic energy research development. But since me and you have spoken more about it, do you want to start talking about Sapphire Project and what they're really trying to, you know, get done here?
Oh, absolutely. I've been researching the Sapphire Project for a few years now. I have attempted to listen to virtually all of the videos that are online about the Sapphire Project. There are a bunch of them, if you know where to look. Some of them are on YouTube. There are others on Vimeo. They're kind of scattered about, but most of them you can find on YouTube. And I would suggest listening to all of them because they each have unique information. And to really understand what's going on with their technology, you really need to watch all of them. Also, the director of the Sapphire Project, Montgomery Childs, has given a few interviews with private parties, and they are on YouTube. And they are very, very interesting to listen to because he's very open. He's very sincere. He is willing to answer just about anything. And I would absolutely recommend people listen to those interviews. But to get started about the Sapphire Project, it was originally established to test the electrical sun model. Basically, that's the idea that the sun has an electrical component. That in addition, or maybe instead of the fact that nuclear reactions are taking place in the core of the sun, the mainstream theory, and the energy is slowly released to the exterior of the sun, that instead the sun is predominantly positively charged in an overall negatively charged space environment. And there's theories that this interaction between the positively charged sun and these Birkeland currents, or currents of electrical energy that go from solar system to solar system throughout the galaxy, they remotely bring energy to the sun. And so it was a theory to test. I mean, the Sapphire Project was started to test that theory. But what's important to address from the beginning is that the Sapphire Project is not part of the electrical universe. It's not part of, for example, the Thunderbolts Project, which is a website in an organization that discusses the electrical universe concept. They're independent. They were basically hired to be almost like auditors to run experiments with their system, to determine one way or the other if the electrical sun model could be valid. It didn't matter to them if it was or it wasn't. They were impartial. They just wanted to find out. And from the start, they began building and testing. They were not doing theoretical research. They were actually building real-world equipment and devices. And they started building a device in a bell jar. And then they moved up to the Sapphire Reactor. Basically, the Sapphire Reactor is a large device with all sorts of equipment attached to it to monitor temperatures, to monitor the plasma within the device. And it's composed of, in simplest terms, two large flat cathodes with, it's not always hollow, but it can be hollow, a hollow anode in between them. And basically, when they fire it up, these electrical double layers form around the central anode. And a double layer is when you have positive ions on one side and electrons on the other side. And that double layer is that thin zone where it's literally two layers of positive ions and electrons. And they are able to produce these huge, brilliant plasma balls. There's pictures of them on their website. You can see these pictures and videos of this on YouTube, and it's beautiful. And they know exactly how to produce them. And they use gases such as hydrogen, deuterium, argon, nitrogen, oxygen, helium to produce these. And a lot of times they use a combination of nitrogen and hydrogen in the experiments that produce excess heat. They have conducted many experiments with that. You can tell that by watching their videos. And the anode material can be one of many different materials. They use high nickel, at least 20% nickel steel. They've used tungsten anodes. They've used iron anodes. They've used all kinds of custom alloys. There's scuttlebutt that they've been using, chromium, molybdenum, and other elements as well. And basically, they're doing experiments originally when they first got started that were done 50-100 years ago. This isn't the basic idea that you can create these electrical double layers or these plasma balls, which I like to call a macro scale EVO, isn't really new, because people have been conducting these experiments for a very, very long time. But most mainstream scientists, and you can go online and read the papers about this, this is the basic concept of creating double layers around an anode is very, very, very well known, but most mainstream scientists were not looking for excess heat production. They were not looking for these various anomalies or transmutations. But the Sapphire Project did start looking for them, and they realized that when they would increase their current, and in their system, the current and voltage is precisely controlled. But apparently, once you get an adequate voltage, it's good enough. You really don't have to adjust it much. So let's say they have 600 volts, and this is a low pressure plasma too. It's you probably just, you know, maybe 3 or 4 torr, which is a measure of pressure. So it's a very low pressure plasma. And when they turn up the current, they go through all these transitions, and you can watch them describe these transitions in some of their videos. First, you'll see these little tufts appear on the anode, these little balls equally spaced on the surface of the anode. As they increase the current a little more, these little balls will start to spin. They increase it a little more, they start to form what looks like, to me in one video at least, almost like little brain matter structures, like the surface of the brain on the anode. I know that sounds weird, but it's just what came to mind when I watched the video. And then as they increase it a little more, the double layers start to form, these nested double layers within each other. And they increase it even more, and they expand out. And then they increase it a little more, and then instantly it will collapse. All these double layers collapse down very close to the surface of the anode. And there's a very intense voltage drop of up to 1,000 volts that is created right near the surface. And that mode right there is when the excess heat production begins. And that's when the transmutations, both on the surface of the anode and in the gaseous environment, takes place. And they can monitor this in real time with their equipment. And they have, for example, they have verified their transmutations, because they have talked to different parties from the DOD. They have talked to parties in various government agencies, and they have directed them to third-party laboratories that are used by companies like Lockheed to test the surface of, you know, to make an analysis, a third-party analysis of, for example, the surface of their anode to look for these transmutation products. And they submitted their anodes, and they found them. So they have verification of that. What's also pretty cool is all the transmutation products are stable elements. They're not radioactive. So this doesn't produce any nuclear waste of any kind, which is really cool. They also don't produce any nuclear waste or radioactive emissions like, you know, traditional nuclear reactors would. So any questions so far?
Well, there's one very notable scientist that most people on this community should know about, which is Dr. Harold Puthoff, who is involved quite directly with the Sapphire Project, right?
Absolutely. I don't know the extent of his day-to-day interaction with the Sapphire Project, and I don't think he's actually working with them like day after day or conducting experiments with them, but he is on their scientific advisory board. And also Eric W. Davis, who was Dr. Puthoff's former chief scientist at EarthTech, he is on their scientific advisory board. And that's very, very interesting because there's the scuttlebutt. But we do know that Dr. Eric Davis proposed in his ball lightning study, which is available online, that he did for the Air Force Research Laboratory at Edwards Air Force Base, that he proposed a replication of a classic Kenneth Shoulders EVO generator. And that's public, but there's scuttlebutt, and we don't have absolute proof for this, but Dr. Stephen Greer discussed this during a lecture that used to be on YouTube, but I cannot find it anymore. It must have been removed or something, or delisted. But he describes how one of his disclosure project witnesses, who was a PhD scientist, basically was given a tour of the Air Force Research Laboratory at Edwards Air Force Base, and he was shown a device that he was told produced excess energy. It extracted zero point energy, but they didn't know how to scale up the effect. And basically, when he drew out a diagram of what he saw, it was a dead ringer for a classic Kenneth Shoulders EVO generator, exactly the same thing. So apparently it looks like Dr. Eric Davis did get his project approved. However, the scuttlebutt that I've also heard is that at the last minute, when he was going to write up a paper about the device, the whole project was classified. So again, that scuttlebutt, I don't have absolute confirmation, but that's what I've heard. But to continue about the Sapphire Project, I wanted to say too, what's so interesting about their technology is that in most of these experimental fusion reactors, and they're not claiming they are inducing fusion because they're not bound by any one theory. They are not claiming, okay, it's this theory that's making my system work, or it's this theory. No, they are trying to be pragmatic. They are trying to be open-minded. And they realize there are many theories that could explain this, but figuring out the nitty-gritty of scientifically what's happening is not their job. They're trying to now their new mandate is for them to develop a clean energy technology and also technology that can remediate nuclear waste with the same technology. And so they are saying, hey, look, and they don't say this by these words, but this is just the idea I get. Scientists will have 100 years or more to try and figure out all the nitty gritty after this is on the market. They'll have plenty of time. You see, they don't want to waste years trying to get a long series of papers through peer review boards. you know, that would be a battle that would take up so much time, so much resources. They just want to get this on the market to benefit humanity rather than just have it become one big debate in academia, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Do you think there might be any behind-the-scenes collaboration between them and TTSA?
That's a very interesting question. Obviously, Dr. Harold Puthoff, who's a member of TTSA, is very aware of the Sapphire Project. I believe what the Sapphire Project is doing is leaps and bounds more important than anything TTSA have announced they're working on themselves. And I'm not 100% sure, like, for example, the Sapphire Project would ever want to be officially affiliated with Stars Academy, because, you know, their technology, although it's completely real and they've had third party confirmations that it works, that they are producing transmutation, that their measurements are correct and so forth. It's still controversial. Any of these radical new technologies are controversial, and they probably don't want to add to that by being officially connected to the Stars Academy. That's just my guess. But, you know, the whole thing is, though, I believe this is this technology that the Sapphire Project is working on is the same technology, but in a slightly different form that's used in UFOs. Because what I also should mention is that the Sapphire Project, right there at the border of the double layer, when it collapses down, there's a very, very sharp voltage gradient. And they have done, they've taken all kinds of measurements of the plasma. And for example, first of all, I need to say this. I think I forgot to say it earlier. In traditional hot fusion reactors, you have to have external magnetic fields to contain the plasma. Sometimes they are even talking about utilizing superconducting magnets to contain the plasma in conventional hot fusion reactor designs. But in the Sapphire Project, you don't need external magnetic fields because the double layers themselves contain the plasma. You see, that's what's so great about the Sapphire Project. Basically, you give the plasma what it wants. You give this plasma ball what it needs, which is basically electrons, because these plasmas, they feed off the energy of these electrons and ions. So you give it what it wants, and it does everything for you. You don't force it to do anything. You just basically gently guide it, and it does everything. It's brilliant. But right there at the surface of the double layer, there's an extreme voltage drop, and they actually built a dual Langmuir probe. So you have two Langmuir probes right beside each other. They inserted them into the plasma, and right there near the surface of the anode, the electrical resistance dropped to zero. And that could be a sign that it's a superconducting layer of electrons, which have lost their individuality and have actually became Cooper pairs and have formed kind of like a, I hate using a buzzword like this, but like a quantum membrane around the anode. And if that's the case, that could be why this, they have hinted at that their double layers can shield gravity. They have not went into detail about this. They've only mentioned this a couple of times, but they have hinted at that there's gravity shielding taking place. So I think that's a connection to what we're going to be talking about next.
Yeah, for sure.
Before we move on, though, any questions about the Sapphire Project? I mean, just pick my brain. Feel free to ask me anything.
Well, I was going to just quickly say, just as well, in regards to some people that might not be aware. Now, obviously, with this type of technology, we talk about aerospace applications and faster than light travel. But can you kind of expand on what maybe some of the potential global applications of this technology could be for the planet and for for our systems?
Well, you know, just talking for now about energy production with the Sapphire Project technology. Basically, it could, number one, in the fossil fuel age, obviously, because instead of burning chemical fuels, you could use a variety of ordinary common elements and hydrogen to produce an unlimited amount of energy. And since this technology would be scalable, you could either have power plants for a city utilizing this technology, producing ultra cheap energy, or you could have home units that could be maybe the size of a window air conditioning unit that could produce the power for your home, or could be used in vehicles, hypothetically, to produce electricity to power your car. There's no limit to the applications of this technology. It would, and they try not to call this free energy technology. That's one thing they have stressed, because there's always a cost to energy. Even with this system, there are materials involved to build the actual units, which would have a cost. You know, there's always a cost of some sort with energy. So they like to look at this in terms of efficiency. Mm-hmm. And it's just my personal opinion, not theirs, but my personal opinion, if you looked at this in terms of efficiency, it would be beyond solar. It would be beyond wind. I believe this could become the predominant energy production technology for the next few hundred years, at least, maybe longer. Yeah. Because, you know, not only is this producing energy, or they believe it's producing energy from transmutations, there may be a method involved here, and they don't actually say this because, again, they try to be agnostic when it comes to the theory, but this could be tapping energy directly from the zero-point energy field. So this technology could literally help transform our civilization from one of resource scarcity to abundance. It could, if used appropriately by mankind, and that's the key, if used appropriately, it could help bring all these third world countries out of poverty. It could help solve many of the challenges facing your civilization as our population continues to skyrocket. It could, very importantly, help humanity prepare for black swan events that could be coming. Right now, this coronavirus could, even though it's something that's happened before, you know, with like the flu of 1918, the Spanish flu of 1918, mm-hmm. this coronavirus could be considered a black swan event because it's disrupting the whole planet. And but there's many others that could happen too. We could have an asteroid impact because there's still asteroids to be found in our solar system. They haven't charted yet. There are also the potential for solar flares. You may have read about the Carrington event in the 1800s. In the late 1800s, there was this massive series of solar storms that literally fried the very early primitive electrical grid around the planet. And if that were to hit today, our civilization would just be taken out pretty much instantly. There would be millions of transformers blown across the planet, and they wouldn't be enough to replace them. And with the electrical grid down and the absolute chaos, we wouldn't be able to manufacture more of them because our industrial production would just collapse. So that's another potential black swan event. Also, who knows? There could be a giant volcanic eruption, you know, Yellowstone every so often. That giant magma pool in Yellowstone erupts every so, you know, every so many hundreds of thousands of years. There's all kinds of things we can't even predict that could happen in the future. But an unlimited source of dirt cheap clean energy, like what the Sapphire Project reactor offers, could be a solution that could help us prepare for these black swan events that could literally, if not make humanity go extinct, send us back to the Stone Age.
Are you optimistic about the future?
I'm only optimistic about the future if the UFO cover-up is completely and totally disclosed in full. If that does not happen, I'm very pessimistic about the future.
What does that mean to you, disclosed in full, in your opinion?
I believe this full disclosure means that the powers that be, however it happens, whoever they want their figurehead to be, whether it goes through the White House or whether it's a representative from one of these legacy aerospace corporations, whether it's a former director of special programs for the Office of the Undersecretary for Defense Technology and Acquisition, whoever does it, that they admit that they, number one, have recovered crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft with bodies. Number two, they have been working on them, analyzing them, reverse engineering them, you know, since Roswell or even before. And three, admit the truth that they have had vehicles like the Flux Liner ARV, which stands for Alien Reproduction Vehicle, ever since the 60s. And if they admit to that, the whole world changes instantaneously. We will live in a completely different world that will impact every single aspect of human civilization. And if that happens, I believe the type of changes that are required to allow humanity to progress in a positive manner can happen. If that information is not released and we continue to live in this little false reality, this false narrative that's perpetuated by those in charge of the UFO cover-up, then I believe that we won't be prepared for the challenges ahead of us, that we will continue to slide towards an abysmal future where their environment is ruined, where the population continues to grow, yet we don't have the resources to provide for everyone, where any number of calamities could take place. So I just believe, you know, exposing the UFO cover-up is the most important issue there is right now, because once the UFO cover-up is revealed in full, and I don't mean a drip feed, these videos, we're getting a little bit off topic, but these videos TTSA have put out are fascinating. They're interesting. But there have been fantastic, amazing UFO sightings witnessed by qualified people, often even tracked on radar for, you know, 70 years, ever since the late 40s, 50s, there have been such UFO sightings. These are not new. Tic-tac type vehicles are not a new phenomenon. They've been here forever. But 100 new tic-tac videos of some objects, you know, flying in the sky isn't going to bring about disclosure. What we need is for them to tell the truth that they have had these vehicles ever since the 40s because they crashed, they recovered these nearly intact vehicles, and they've been working on them, because once the reality is admitted that they actually have physical craft that are mostly intact, there's no debate any longer. Objects in the sky can be debated, okay? Even if the evidence is overwhelming that it's truly not of this world, that it has astounding performance capabilities, there's still going to be skeptics, and there's still going to be debunkers, and there's still going to be naysayers planting seeds of doubt on the internet by making up crazy explanations. But once they admit they have the craft and they have the bodies, then there's no debate. It's settled. The world will wake up and realize, hey, we have multiple extraterrestrial species visiting Earth on a regular basis. And that's what's going to change the world.
I agree completely. And with that, should we talk about the Flux Liner a little bit?
Absolutely. The Flux Liner ARV is one of my favorite topics in ufology.
Please. Give the story to people that don't know about it.
Okay. It was, I believe, 1988 when graphics illustrator Mark McCandlish, who's a great guy, by the way, got a call from his friend Brad Sorensen, who told him that they were invited to attend an air show at Norton Air Force Base. At first, he was planning to go with his friend Brad Sorensen. But then Mark McCandlish got a telephone call, I believe it was from Popular Mechanics, and they needed him to do a rush job over the weekend for a cover for Popular Mechanics. And he, and financially, it would be a quick, I think he said like $1,000 or something, which back then was a decent amount of money. He couldn't just not do it. He needed the money. So he couldn't go to the air show. So his friend went. And his friend Brad Sorensen was at Norton Air Force Base, and he saw these conventional aircraft and so forth, you know, jet fighters and the stealth bomber and stuff like that. But then a friend of his that was affiliated with the Department of Defense, and we really don't know for sure who he was, but there's speculation about it, told him, "You're going to come with me to a special show." So they boarded this airplane that took them to Lockheed's huge hangar out in Palmdale. And his friend told Brad Sorensen, "Just be quiet. Don't talk to anybody. Follow my lead. You know, just observe. Don't ask questions. You'll be fine." So he follows this guy into the Lockheed hangar, and they start showing off these semi-mundane vehicles like hovercraft and the pumpkin seed demonstrator, which was another top secret craft. But, you know, these vehicles that were probably classified, but were using traditional propulsion systems. But then there was this big curtain. And when they pulled the curtain, there were these three hovering saucers. And basically, they looked a little bit like a cross between a flying saucer and a submarine. And they were flat on the bottom. They looked kind of like a jello mold with a little bubble on top. And they were three different sizes. One was about 35 foot in diameter. I think the other was maybe around 60 foot in diameter. And then there was the largest one that was about 130 feet in diameter. And they were called the Baby Bear, the Mama Bear, and the Papa Bear. And there was a general there who was talking about these three hovering vehicles. And he went into great detail to describe them. And from what Brad Sorensen said about these vehicles, the whole reason they were showing them off was to convince these senators to allow for a production run of 30 of them designed to function as an instantaneous nuclear weapon deployment system. Instantaneous. Where it would be faster than an ICBM. It would literally just instantly be there. And the general basically said that these vehicles could travel light speed or better. They had already been sent on missions around the solar system to explore, you know, different bodies and planets. He talked to some degree about how it worked. There was also like there was actual how Brad Sorensen got to see the inside of it was they had taken off some of the panels around the bottom. So he could see on the inside a central column, which we'll be discussing in a little while. A big central column. There was this pneumatic claw, for example, that he imagined would be for like picking up a specimen. Like, let's say it landed on an asteroid or landed on Mars. It could reach out and grab something. There were all these gas canisters in there. And what was also fascinating is that the general said these craft were powered by the zero point energy field, that they literally extracted energy from the vacuum. And actually, to start them up, they just used two 12 volt marine lead acid batteries, basically a jump start the whole thing. Because the whole thing was designed basically as a Tesla coil. There on the very bottom, there were these layered capacitors, which we'll get to in a little while. And then there was a big coil embedded around the top portions. They're all function sort of like a giant Tesla coil. Anyway, and the general talked about it for a while. And then afterwards, Brad Sorensen and his friend flew off when it was over. Well, a couple of days passed, and he contacted Mark McCandlish, and he tells Mark, "You know, I think I saw something I really wasn't allowed to see." And Mark was like, "Well, Everything at Norton Air Force Base was for public display, but then he starts telling Mark what he really did see, and Mark starts drawing a diagram of what he's being described, and he works with Mark McCandlish to make this famous diagram. It's on tons of websites, and there's a great documentary on YouTube called Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV. Again, I want to repeat the title of this. Look this up on YouTube. I suggest everyone look this up. It's called Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV. It was made by a SCAD student in Savannah, Georgia. And this SCAD student who made it as part of his, I think it was like a thesis for what he was studying.
That's amazing.
It's a great documentary. What's very mysterious is before it was actually finished, he ended up getting a very rare form of cancer. And when he died, they discovered that he had heavy metals in his system. Wow. So it theorized by some he could have been murdered. Like, there's a big bar scene in that area, allegedly, that somebody could have slipped, you know, something in one of his drinks.
Yeah.
And so nobody knows for sure, but it's a fact that he had heavy metals in his body. And so this documentary goes into great detail about the structure of this craft. And so rather than listen to me, after you finish listening to this interview, check out that video, Zero Point, the Fluxliner ARV is what you need to Google. And it describes all of this in great detail. Well, Mark McCandlish ends up joining with Putoff and a few others in kind of like a loose confederation to start really investigating this, the Fluxliner ARV. And Mark McCandlish ends up getting some sources, other people who have seen the Fluxliner ARV in different circumstances. Like, he finds a witness that was at, I forgot the name of the Air Force Base. I want to say Edwards, but I'm not 100% sure. He was at Edwards Air Force Base. May have been a different one. And this guy was transporting a generator that was electrical generator that was malfunctioning. And instead of going around this area of the base at night, in the middle of the night, he cut through it and he saw this hangar and he just saw something peculiar inside. He got closer and he realized it was a hovering UFO. And guess what? It was what he didn't realize it at the time, but it was a Fluxliner. And apparently this guy was interrogated. He was brought into a little room. They interrogated him for hours, but then they gave him a little bit more information about it, because that's a very typical tactic when it comes to people who obtain UFO-related information. It's called limited hangout. If you find something out that you're not supposed to know, they will do a limited hangout, which means they give you a little more information, but then make you sign security oaths and NDAs, basically forbidding you from ever speaking about any of it. It's basically a form of a trap to silence you. So they did that with him. And he talked to Mark McCandlish, and he found a couple other witnesses as well. So he got confirmation that the craft existed. What's very interesting to me about the Fluxliner from a technological point of view is that there's an inner column in the Fluxliner. And in this inner column, there's a self-organizing plasma of mercury isotope 199. And mercury isotope 199 is a very special isotope. Number one, it's important because it has a high atomic mass. It would have a higher atomic mass than any noble gas except for radon, which no one would want to mess with radon because it's, you know, radioactive and dangerous. But it would have a high atomic mass, and that's ideal for forming a macro scale EVO, because you would want the largest difference between the mass of the positive ion of mercury and the electrons. Because when you have that higher mass differential, it helps with the formation of the plasma. Also, it has a low vaporization temperature, which means they wouldn't have to heat it to some extreme temperature to get it started. Also, mercury, this is also important, when it's doubly ionized, which means that the two valence electrons on the outer shell are removed, it becomes a pseudo-noble gas configuration, which makes it non-reactive with other gases and materials, which is very important because you don't want some gas that's going to corrode away the casing of the central column. You just don't want that. Also, it has what's called a half-integer nuclear spin. And this is important because it would allow for an enhancement of the spin polarization of the nuclear spin of the ion. And because if it was, there's other isotopes of mercury as well, but some of them have what's called a quadrupolar moment. And in a quadrupolar moment, the plasma could not be as easily spin polarized. If you used another isotope, the relaxation time would be decreased, which basically means that it would not stay spin polarized for as long. And you want the plasma to be spin polarized so that basically all of the ions are moving in unison with each other. All the spins are aligned is what spin polarization means. So it's perfect for that. Mercury isotope 199 is really just the ideal element to use to produce such a self-organizing plasma.
So I was just going to ask how far away you think we are in the public sector with things like the Sapphire Project in regards to creating something like a flux liner.
Well, the problem is most mainstream scientists don't have a clue about this.
Yeah, exactly. Most this is the thing, because we've got things like SpaceX, and you've got, you know, Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos going up in rockets, and you've got a small Sapphire Project working on something potentially completely breakthrough and completely, you know, planet changing, and yet the funding for it is minute.
Well, I mean, most of these mainstream emerging aerospace corporations, at least publicly, they're oblivious to all of this. They don't know any of this. I doubt Elon Musk or individuals like him have ever even heard of EVOs before. He has never worked in a special access program as far as I am aware. And to really learn about this, you really have to do some serious research. And this material is not published everywhere.
Oh, for sure. I mean, he must be aware of, like, you know, of, like, novel kind of like ways in which energy can be produced and exotic concepts. Because, I mean, most scientists can understand it, but would just dismiss it as, you know, something that's 500 to 1,000 years into the future or just not possible. And so, I don't know. I mean, you know, where do you see things like the Sapphire Project going? Do you see them honestly being able to push through and create something within our lifetimes that can be representative of apparently things that we've been having locked away in military bunkers for over, you know, 50 years potentially?
Well, you know, the Sapphire Project, I think their technology I don't think they're going to get suppressed. I think there's enough information out there now in the public domain that has emerged from the LENR community, that's low energy nuclear reactions. The cold fusion or LENR field is finally waking up to the EVO reality. And enough of this is finally getting out there. I don't think it can be suppressed completely. I want to go back to mercury isotope 119 and how the flux liner would work. So you have this self-organizing plasma of mercury isotope 199, and it's possible they may add a few other elements to it. We don't know 100% for sure. Apparently, one insider did claim that they were using isotope 199, and that makes perfect sense if you have studied the phenomena of self-organizing plasma. That mercury isotope has the properties that would be most beneficial. So that just, it makes perfect sense. But now, if you have this self-organizing plasma, and it's producing an EVO in the central column, it could develop this superconducting double layer, which would almost be like a layer of electrons that have formed Cooper pairs and become superconducting. Now, what's so interesting about that is I believe from the research I have done that it's a superconducting state, which is highly interactive with the vacuum, with the zero-point energy field. And basically, you can create a bubble of what's called magnetic vector potential around the craft. Now, this is a very important concept I want to get across here about magnetic vector potential. See, originally, Maxwell, back in the 1800s, produced the first theory of electromagnetism, of electrodynamics. And in his original theory, the primary movers of electromagnetism was the scalar potential and the vector potential. And forget the term potential. That's really not a good descriptor of this. But the scalar potential, just imagine for a moment that there's a river and you're underneath the surface of the river. The scalar potential would be the pressure of the water all around you, pushing against your body. That's the scalar, or the static potential. That's always there. The vector potential would be the force of the current flowing against your body, pushing against you in a specific direction, a specific vector. That's the vector potential. The magnetic and electric fields are just various manifestations of the scalar and vector potentials. A magnetic field is just a curled vector potential, for example. And so with the flux liner, you're creating a bubble of vector potential around the craft.
Right.
Then if you pulse it, because remember, the flux liner was designed as like a high frequency Tesla coil. Mm-hmm. If you pulse it, that creates another gradient in the vector potential, which is critical. Also, if you make this bubble asymmetrical in shape, that's important by creating another level of a gradient. Also, you can even do things as there's a secondary propulsion system in the flux liner too, which were the dielectric materials at the very base. There were these copper, it was layers of copper and dielectric. Copper and dielectric, this green material. And basically what makes perfect sense for this green material, the dielectric material, would have been doped barium titanate. And it would have had a high K value, which would be a high capacitive value. And what's so interesting about this is that type of ferroelectric material can have a natural nonlinearity about it. So you have all these ways of adding an additional gradient. So you have the natural property of the EVO to be highly interactive with the vector potential. And then you have all these extra gradients from being pulsed at high frequency and having the shape of the craft and having the properties of the dielectric, and it all contributes to having a higher pressure on one side, a weaker pressure on the other side, and creating a net movement. Because gravity, this is a key concept I want your listeners to grasp. Gravity, mass, and inertia are all electrical phenomena. They are all manifestations of the scalar and vector potentials. But here's the thing. For the past nearly 100 years, most mainstream scientists have denied even the reality of the scalar and vector potentials. They try to say they're nothing but mathematical abstractions, because about 100 years ago, it may not have been quite that long, Heaviside, which was another scientist, he gutted Maxwell's original equations and he quoted this himself. He said he murdered the vector potential. He despised the concept of it. He said it complicated the equation. So he just removed it. And that's another reason I think we're held back scientifically as a civilization, because how can we learn to manipulate gravity, mass, and inertia if we deny the existence of this universal medium, the scalar potential and the vector potential, all around us? If it doesn't exist, we can't learn how to engineer it.
I think it's quite ironic that science has slipped into quite dogmatic and almost religious belief systems just in regards to very, you know, guarded parameters that they maintain. And especially if someone's been a pioneer in that field, or written various papers and is a very acclaimed scientist, and then someone's coming and essentially disproving their understanding of physics or their concept that they've been addressing through their topics, people are very quick to respond with the ego. And I think that it plays a major role. And I think that probably people's egos and the lack of wanting to have one bruised has probably played a major role in suppressing this on its own, because people just don't want to try and address it, especially if it disproves their own theories.
Of course. Mainstream science is very much like a cult, because they have their own pet theories. They don't like to stray from the mainstream. They're very dogmatic. The whole peer review process is rigged, so only papers that toe the mainstream line will ever get published in 99% of cases. And that's why a lot of scientists around the world, because there's a growing number of scientists that are realizing that the scalar potential and vector potential is indeed real, because there's been a multitude of experiments again and again and again that prove it's real. Hal Puthoff, for example, has patents on transmitters that utilize the scalar and vector potential. And there's some other great papers out there. For example, there's the theory of fluidic electrodynamics by A.A. Martins, Alexandra A. Martins. And he's a scientist that has published a series of papers where he compares electrodynamics to hydrodynamics, basically proposing that there's a universal ether around us that acts as a superfluid, and that when you compare hydrodynamics to electrodynamics, it all lines up. You realize they're completely analogous to each other. And he has a number of great papers out there, but the mainstream doesn't even talk about his work. Also, there's another guy, I'm not sure of his educational background, but he has written a paper online called A Brief Introduction to Scalar Physics. His name is Thomas Mindele, and it's called A Brief Introduction to Scalar Physics. It's a great document, and he has done a ton of research where he lays out how gravity, mass, inertia, even time itself is controlled by the scalar and vector potentials. And he has written a very good paper on this. And he has a website at montalk.net, MONTALK.net. And there's a section on scalar physics. But this guy has posted a lot of information, and I think he's a genius. And he explains this with illustrations and graphics so that the ordinary person can comprehend it. And, and one thing, a couple more things about the flux line I want to mention. What's so critical is there's a lot of talk today in ufology about UFOs require these super advanced metamaterials with nanolayer. That's not required to build anti-gravity vehicles. And I don't think all UFOs had such exotic metamaterials. Some probably did, but I don't think they all did. I think the idea that we have to master the production of these exotic metamaterials to produce an anti-gravity craft is a flat-out lie.
Do you think that Hal Puthoff is aware of something like that?
I don't think Hal Puthoff is lying about this. I think he is just repeating what he knows. Because remember, Hal Puthoff knows a lot, but he is not a true insider. People like Puthoff, people like Kit Green, others on his team, they've been trying to get into the inside of this for a very, very long time. I would call them quasi-insiders, because at most they've had some little peaks. They have talked to some people that have given them some amazing information. They have nuggets of information that are pure gold, and most of this they have not even shared yet. They're keeping a lot of this information close to their chest organization.
Would you say that he's aware of the fact that these types of metamaterials that are on the kind of nano scale and isotopic ratios, do you think he knows that that's not necessary for anti-gravity travel?
I cannot say absolutely one way or the other, and I don't want to make any accusations whatsoever because I have a lot of respect for Hal Puthoff. He has been in this field a very long time. He has made many very significant contributions to this field and to science in general. But I will say that I think that he probably realizes that metamaterials are not required for anti-gravity vehicles, but that's just a guess on my part. But I was going to say is for the Fluxliner ARV, it was developed in the late 1950s, early 1960s. The most advanced material, which we had in the 60s, this is a material you can look back at the literature and see was doped barium titanate. And it was around back then. That was the green material that the capacitor plates were in. That was probably the most advanced material in the craft. What's also go ahead.
Sorry, I've heard about like the magnesium bismuth skin with like monoatomic iridium like displaced through it in like a crystalline structure. That was something that there was like a source who was claiming to have been an S4 physicist speaking with Linda Moulton Howe, who had said that we'd been using like a, you know, this magnesium bismuth skin that had a, yeah, like monoatomic iridium or something of that description displaced throughout it. Is that something that you've heard of before?
I've heard of things like that. I was just going to say that this is generally speaking, you know, and I'm not trying to speak in absolutes here, but I think there's probably at least two types of vehicles. There may be more. There may be hybrids. I think there's some UFOs that have crashed that utilize these plasma cores with self-organizing plasmas, because the Fluxliner ARV was reproduced from a crashed UFO. However, I think there's probably others in this second type we may not have had as much success reproducing. Maybe we have by now. But I think this second type uses these advanced metamaterials. Right. And they may be even a little more sophisticated than the other craft. Because, again, there's not just one species visiting Earth. And it makes sense they would have different technologies. But about the Fluxliner, this is an important thing to note. Richard D'Amato, also known as Dick D'Amato, was the chief legal counsel for Senator Byrd. And he was tasked by Senator Byrd and other interested senators. This was back, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s, to investigate these carved out, waived, unacknowledged special access programs to see if we really were reverse engineering crashed UFOs. And he's mentioned multiple times in Jacques Vallée's books, Forbidden Science. And there's some fascinating quotes of his in there. He was also mentioned in Gordon Neville's manuscripts in one of his books, which is available online. Gordon Neville was a very interesting character that was associated with Mark McCandless and Puthoff. He was a part of that group that was investigating the claims of Brad Sorensen and the claims of these other people who had witnessed the Fluxliner. And Gordon Neville claimed that in a recorded interview, this recording is lost forever, but he claimed that he had Senator Byrd on tape saying that he discovered that the United States government in the 50s and 60s, from the late 50s to early 60s, that the United States government spent $75 billion reverse engineering in building a man-made UFO. How he discovered that, we don't know. Richard D'Amato currently does not comment on these issues. You know, he has a disclaimer on his website. If you go to his official website, he has a disclaimer about this, basically a very quick denial of everything. But right. He claimed to Gordon Neville, allegedly, if Gordon Neville is telling the truth, if you believe him, that he discovered that $75 billion was spent replicating this technology. And like I said before, I believe the Fluxliner ARV was most likely just the first of a long series of different vehicles that utilized this self-organizing plasma technology. And I believe this version of the technology is way simpler than the metamaterials. I think the whole idea of having to, you know, utilizes metamaterials to produce anti-gravity is a distraction. I believe it's to push us off course, because these special access programs know that they're not absolutely required. And if that technology ever got out, this self-organizing plasma technology, and if the truth came out that we've developed anti-gravity vehicles, every country in the world could reproduce this in no time flat. And just imagine how much money Lockheed, for example, would lose, because they sell billions of dollars every year worth of aircraft to the United States military. And they like that because it's a constant, steady, secure income stream. And if all of a sudden they had 100 different competitors around the world building vehicles that could do laps around an F-18, then they would lose money. And their bottom line is more important to them than anything else. And so they don't want this technology to emerge, because it would literally change every aspect of human civilization.
So kind of almost going back to the Salvatore patents and things kind of coming out of TTSA, and would you be of the opinion that this is, I mean, it is essentially, there are elements of this which are a disclosure, because there has been information provided to the public just in regards to removing stigma on the UFO subject in some ways. But would you say that the actual bare bones technology aspect, the release of patents, the kind of discussions of technology that's already been given, the kind of time scale that's been given in regards to this is still maybe 100 years ahead of where we are right now, would you say that that element of the disclosure is actually misinformation and maybe misdirection for foreign countries when they're looking at what's happening in America? And they're maybe giving them technology, like we said, with the patents, that are potentially misdirections away from the more simplistic technology that they're trying to keep a hold of.
I would agree with that. In essence, I think what they are doing, and again, I don't think the inventor of these patents, I have trouble pronouncing his name. I want to say that he seems like a very bright guy, a very intelligent guy. I think he's being honest, and I don't think he's in on anything. But I think his supervisors, for the same reasons you're saying, are letting these patents go through, or actually contacting the patent office, you know, and trying to support these patents and push them through so that can serve the function you just described, to basically distract people away from the true simplicity of the real anti-gravity technologies. And I'm not saying these patents wouldn't work. I'm just saying, in my opinion, they're overly complicated. I think they are a distraction. They're basic concepts. And he describes systems that would be, you know, very, in some cases, a little convoluted to actually build from a practical point of view. You know, like one of his fusion reactors that he proposes. The Sapphire Project system is way, way, way simpler. It would be way more straightforward to build than what he proposes. So I think you are correct.
Go ahead. And so do you think that this maybe even could be a direct response to things like the Sapphire Project? And you've maybe got these people sitting on these committees in these, you know, special access and unacknowledged and waived programs, who are seeing the world starting to shift into an understanding of these physics, and are going, right, well, we need to try and slow this down even more.
Possibly.
Because it just seems a little bit ridiculous. It's like they're just holding back the inevitable, really.
Yeah. I mean, there's always been this duality. You know, for many decades, there have been intentional controlled leaks of information. For example, there was the whole UFO Live televised documentary that leaked some information about Area 51 and MJ-12 and so forth. And then you had all these MJ-12 documents that leaked out to Bill Moore, and that leaked out to Timothy Cooper, and leaked out to other people. And then there have been all these other attempts, you know, like, for example, the documents that Linda Moulton Howe was presented at Kirtland Air Force Base by Richard Doty. There's this continual effort And I'm not saying Richard Doty was intentionally giving her information. He was just obeying orders. But there's this continual effort, it seems, to push out legitimate ideas, the basic concepts. Yes, we're being visited. Yes, there's multiple species. Yes, there were crash recoveries. Yes, there's reverse engineering. However, they mix in disinformation with it. They always mix in other stuff. And they mix in this stuff. Number one, it's for different purposes. I think it's to distract some parties, like, you know, maybe in other countries or even in our own country, distract people from how the technology really works. Number two, I think it is to make the story seem so crazy that most people won't take them seriously because they know the truth of the UFO reality. It might take another 100 years, but eventually it's going to come out because the UFO reality isn't changing. The UFOs are here. They've been here for thousands of years. They're probably going to continue visiting this planet for thousands of years. It's not going anywhere. So it's almost like they want to condition the public to have the concept in their heads, but at the same time, they don't want to give out specifics. They don't want to tell the full truth. They don't want disclosure. So they plant disinformation. And that's what's so horrible about these special access programs. They manipulate the public. They have been manipulating the world, but not only the general public like you and me and UFO researchers. They don't even tell the full truth to 99.9% of the military hierarchy, the generals, the joint
chiefs. Right, and that's the major concern, right?
Yeah, they don't tell them the full truth. When they have we have a right to know, fundamentally. We, the public, the government and the military exist to serve us, we, the people. However, the military has an even more immediate need to know. The leaders of the military need to know the truth, the full truth about all this. Also, their Congress and their senators, they cannot make proper decisions without this information. Not only do they need to make decisions about, you know, technological research, because why should we spend billions of dollars funding hot fusion research or even solar power technologies when we've had, you know, technologies like the core of the flux liner, which produces massive amounts of energy. You know, the taxpayer is being forced to pay for useless research like mainstream hot fusion research when we've already paid for the development of the flux liner, for example. Also, the presidents, I doubt most presidents are even told the full truth about the UFO phenomenon. Obviously, Bill Clinton was not told the full truth because him and Hillary were extremely curious. I doubt they tell most presidents hardly anything. And if they ask, they probably just tell them the smallest amount they can get away with. And it's just, it's completely against the concept of a true democracy. You know, basically, individuals associated with To the Stars Academy, such as, trying to think of his first name. He's a physicist. I think it's Bernard Haish. Bernard Haish had a website that was recently taken down. It was called UFOskeptic.org. But he really wasn't a skeptic. He was a believer because of all the research he did and because what he was told by people, you know, in very prominent positions and scientists and so forth. You know, he was told flat out the people in charge of the UFO cover-up really are elitist. They think they know what's best for humanity. They think only they are qualified to make these decisions. They have complete disregard for the military hierarchy, for our elected officials, our legitimately elected officials in our country, our congressmen, our senators, the president. They think they know better. They think they are these ultra intelligent elites that have somehow they believe they have the right to control this whole topic, but they don't.
That's the thing, isn't it? I mean, in some ways, it's kind of a it's kind of what everyone sometimes suffers from, and I guess it's like self-selected benevolence. You know, you think you're in the right, and you believe you've got the right to do something, and you don't. And this is a really, you know, case in point with this kind of subject in regards to just the acquisition of tech. basically the fact that we're not alone in the universe, and all of these things have been kept not only under wraps, but actually openly mocked and ridiculed in the public, so that we've been given this really skewed perception on the entire subject, which is now having to slowly be on, you know, the damage of that slowly having to be undone. And in regards to democracy, the fact that a large swath of the government is completely unaware of these things, you know, can't even speak for my own government in the UK, because it's even quieter and we have no sort of history really of leaks and whistleblowers. And so I find it interesting that in America, it's almost a phenomena that occurs in America when it comes to leaked documents, declassified documents, whistleblowers, etc. But I was going to say, in regards to the power structure, the control structure of the UFO portfolio, would you say that it is primarily privatized defense contractors, corporate entities that can basically supersede governmental oversight because they're not in government? It's like a gray area.
Absolutely. That is how it works right now. I believe 99% of the control over this has been transferred to the private sector. I think it's mostly not only aerospace corporations, but I think it's legacy aerospace corporations and other private contractors that for decades now have been in charge of this. And they only interface with, for example, the DOD. You know, they interface with the senior review group, and we'll be talking about more about this very soon. They interface with the senior review group of the Special Access Program Oversight Committee, but only to get the billions of dollars in funding they want every year. That's the only reason they interact at all. And as we have learned, and I don't want to go into it quite yet, but as we have learned from the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, they even lie and manipulate and file false paperwork and so forth to get that money from the Pentagon, or at least have in the past. We don't know about currently, but in the past they have. You know, and also, it's not just the DOD. The Department of Energy has their own version of their Special Access Program Oversight Committee, and they have a senior review group. It's not talked about very much, but they have it. And the scuttlebutt is, for a long time, that these UFO programs, many of them have also received funding or could be managed. When I say managed, you know, they're managed by private corporations, but they also receive funding from the Department of Energy, and they can hide behind the Atomic Energy Act of 1954, which would, you know, automatically put them in a beyond top secret status. So all of this has been privatized. But this is what I want to ask you. Consider this for a minute, and I want your opinion on this. Don't you think it's terrifying that for 80 years now, a long time ago, it wasn't even called special access programs. They did not start being called that until at least the 80s. Maybe 70s or 80s, they started being called special access programs. Before that, they were called black programs, or even gray programs was another term that was used. But they've had these technologies from crash recoveries. They may have even had one or more living occupants, because if we believe what Dr. Eric Davis has stated, there was a long series of crash recoveries, not just one. So they may have had even a living extraterrestrial to ask questions to about the technology. So they had billions of dollars to investigate. They had the best human technology at their disposal. They had, you know, they could go to restricted space to do this. So I think, number one, they most likely tried to make official contact with these ET species. I believe that's just the logical conclusion, is that if you know that these godlike craft are flying in our skies and they're crashing, you would try to communicate with them. Now, this is what's terrifying to me, and I would like your opinion on this, that instead of the Congress or the Senate being in charge of the process of making official contact with these ET species, perhaps even conducting negotiations or starting a diplomatic process, that instead of an official democratically elected infrastructure having control, it were these private corporations, it were these elitists, who think they know what's best for the entire world. And to me, that's terrifying. What is your opinion on that?
Yeah, it is terrifying, but I would also come at the angle that we can absolutely supersede that through our own consciousness-initiated contact. I do think that it plays a major role in exactly this, is that, yeah, these people have been in control of the technological acquisition for so long, and that that's probably put them in some form of a position to be able to have meetings and to establish contact with certain, you know, certain extraterrestrial beings. I think that it doesn't prevent us from doing the same thing, because CE5 can be done by, you know, everyone, the average person. And I think that some of the misconceptions behind that kind of contact are just primarily the fact that it's, you know, you people believe you have to get into these extremely deep transcendental states of meditation, like some sort of, you know, yogi or a Buddhist monk on a hillside, and you don't. You need to just get into a very basic, what I believe to be natural state for a human being, once you've got rid of all the signal noise of our normal waking monkey brain experience. And when you sit there and breathe for a moment and bring yourself back to a collective point, I think that that in itself is a way in which we can initiate contact and communications. And well, I say that because I've had successful contact myself, and I haven't been able to have a vocal communication. That's something that I want to have, and I think that it will be possible. I do believe that. But, you know, I mean, I do remember that we spoke about this in regards to the fact that, you know, we maybe don't want to just be having to interact on a telepathic modality, because we're not quite there yet as a species in regards to that being a, you know, an automatic response. So it's still quite difficult, and it would be good to be able to have real conversation through vocalization. And maybe that's possible as well, but maybe that's possible through CE5 as well, if we all actually open ourselves up and allow these things onto the planet and allow them to actually interact with us in a more open environment. But yeah, in regards to these type of sociopathic people that have been running the black budget, you know, underground intelligence operations in regards to all of this type of technology and this type of topics, it's terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, because they're not diplomats.
Well, how I will respond to that is, I don't oppose CE5 initiatives. You know, I believe that there are a wide array of consciousness phenomena. You know, remote viewing is real. Harold Puthoff and his team proved that remote viewing happens. I also have an interest in spoon bending, which is a very real phenomenon. Yes, there are some hoaxers and there's ways to fake it, but if you do the research, you will realize that spoon bending is indeed real. Psychokinesis, the ability to manipulate matter with the mind, is real. You know, I believe that all of this is real. However, at the same time, when it comes to making open and full contact, although I'm not against people attempting to make contact with ETs themselves, I'm not against that any more than I'm against somebody going online and contacting a Chinese person and having a conversation across, you know, the internet with somebody in another country. You know, people should be free to communicate with whoever they want, whether they're other citizens on this planet or if they're citizens of another planet. However, I believe what we need is for the control of the UFO topic to be transferred to the official government, the official elected representatives of this country and other countries too, because ETs are visiting all around the world, you know, traveling. It's not just UFOs, are not only a United States phenomena. And what we need is to start open, face-to-face diplomatic proceedings with these ET species. And I think there's many different species out there. Some of them may be energy-based. Some of them could be basically orb-type entities. Others could be like shapeshifters. You know, some of them could be like, like skinwalkers, for example. They can take whatever form they desire. But some of them, I believe, are predominantly physical entities like you and me, that just have a much higher level of technology, a much more in-depth understanding of the universe, of physical reality. And although it would be great if people want to contact them via different routes, you know, for personal communications, we need our government to, number one, announce all this is real, open up everything, we need a disclosure where photographs of the crafts are revealed, photographs of the bodies, the transcripts of the interviews with the survivors are published. But then we need formal, we need an embassy. Literally, we need an embassy for each alien ET species in Washington, D.C., and have our congressmen and senators meeting them. We could initiate technology transfer. We could start initiating treaties with these different species. We could even start, tourism, for example. I mean, we could let aliens, I love that show. Have you ever watched Alien Nation, the classic science fiction series, Alien Nation?
No, I haven't, no.
Okay, that was a fascinating science fiction series in which this slave ship of these aliens landed in California with a 250,000 aliens on it. And they basically, when it landed, the ship couldn't take off again. So they've just integrated them into ordinary human society. So they were living among us with dogs and so forth. And it was just a fascinating series because it was about a cop with a partner that was an alien. And it was fascinating.
That's great.
So what I'm saying is that although there are a wide variety of species out there, some of them we could probably interact with more efficiently, because even if, and I do believe humans have different abilities, telepathic abilities, you know, these cognitive abilities that we, most of us don't explore, but we don't absolutely have to develop them to interact with many of these species at an official level. And so we could have embassies where we could, human beings could go there and meet these extraterrestrials, and our leaders could talk with them. Go ahead.
I think one point to make, and it's one that doesn't really seem to get made enough, in my opinion, is that, you know, the US government or any person in the entire world is in control fully of disclosure, because, you know, we are looking without a doubt at whatever it is, beings that are far in advance of what we are. And they've, you know, exhibited levels of control in regards to the disengaging of ICBMs and going over nuclear sites and basically proving that, you know, they hold the cards. So is it not also worth considering that they themselves have a responsibility in disclosure, and they haven't really shown much of an intention towards that other than the interactions people have had either through CE5 or through other contacts?
I would disagree, because there have been many crashes of UFOs over the last 80 years. And there have been crashes of nearly intact vehicles. For example, with the Aztec UFO crash, this 99-foot diameter vehicle was mostly intact. And it's my personal opinion, I could be wrong, that the ETs could have recovered all of these vehicles. They could have recovered all the bodies. They could have recovered every scrap of wreckage if they so desired, but they didn't. So I think they left it here. So us poor pathetic monkeys, you know, this primitive species we belong to, all of us, could look at this technology and learn from it. That was their way of initiating disclosure, by leaving that behind. Now it's up to us. It's up to what has now ended up being these special access programs to reveal themselves, to share the information publicly. And I don't think the aliens are in control of that. I personally think the ETs are waiting to see what humanity does with the wreckage, with the bodies, with the knowledge perhaps these living aliens gave. And obviously there are probably computational devices, data storage devices on these UFOs. And by now we may have learned how to access them. So we may have copies in the special access programs in these deep dark bunkers of Encyclopedia Galactica. So it really comes down to, I think what the aliens are doing, are waiting to see what our move is now. So there's nothing stopping these special access programs from opening up, admitting the full truth, except themselves, their own greed, their own lust for power and control over civilization, of maintaining the status quo. Because once this information gets out, you can't put it back in the bottle. Once this information gets out, all of civilization changes in every aspect. It's not just a disruptive technology. It's every everything is going to change. And I think the ETs are waiting to see what we decide to do. That's just my opinion.
No, to be honest, I'm of a really similar mindset. And it's obvious that throughout time, there's been these interfaces that, I would be of the opinion that, should they even be crashing, in the first place, let alone the recovery of the crashes? But should these extremely advanced systems with beings that have, been doing this for a lot longer than we have, should they even be crashing? Or is it just literally to put something in our laps? I mean, Grant Cameron talks about this when he talks about port materials in regards to the fact that there's been so many, like Maury Island and other quite famous cases where you've had these ejections of materials, of things like molten metals, and, different types of strange materials, that you would imagine that it's almost as if it is a trail of breadcrumbs or a carrot on a stick, just kind of pushing humanity forward until we make a quantum leap, so to speak, and actually become unified with this technology and are mature enough. But that's also the issue, I think, for me, is I honestly do have hope for the future, and I do think that we're all going to be a part of quite a big phenomenal change on this planet. But at the same time, we definitely still have a lot of growing up to do, and perhaps are we at a position where we're not ready to be using these technologies yet?
Well, here's the thing. We're at the point in the development of our species where we need these technologies. Mm. If we are going to survive and become a space-faring species that can support, a growing population, then we have to have these technologies. There's no question about it. And we also need to learn the truth that the universe is filled with life, and we are not the only intelligent species in existence. That could unite humanity, because we would learn that our petty differences, such as race and skin color and nationality, are nothing, because we have way more in common than we have different, especially when you compare humanity to the different ET species out there. So
what's your belief in terms of species? What do you honestly feel quite confidently has been here?
Well, I believe alien abductions have indeed taken place. I'm not sure of all the motives, but there have been enough cases, some with evidence, implants, fetuses, or even almost complete term infants, unborn infants that just vanished, that were taken. I believe there's plenty of evidence that abductions have taken, and typically they're conducted by, not always, but the gray aliens. But there seem to be even different categories of gray aliens. So I'm sure whatever they are, that's one category. The Roswell aliens, I'm sure of, but they were not typical grays. They were described as more like almost Oriental, but, bald heads, slightly larger eyes than a human, perhaps a different number of fingers. Not human, but more humanoid than, let's say, the grays. And then there's other kinds of beings that have been seen in abductions, that, again, sometimes people have seen reptilian looking aliens. Other ones have seen human, almost human looking beings doing abductions. Sometimes they're called Nordics. They seem to exist. Also, there have been a lot of landing cases. For example, in France, I believe it was in the 60s, there was an outbreak of landings. And it wasn't just one type of ET. I mean, some of them look like little furry creatures. Other ones almost look like robots. There's been all sorts of sightings. And I think there's probably been, over the last several thousand years, thousands of different species. And, in offshoots of each species visiting this planet. Because if faster than light travel is possible, that means species can expand throughout the galaxy. I think our universe is a crowded place, and I believe that it's very probable that we get lots of visitors, especially over the thousands of years that we've been on this planet. Ancient humans may have had open interactions with multiple different species. The Mayans and Incas could have been interacting with one species. Native Americans somewhere else could have been interacting with others. You know, in Asia, there could have been different encounters. So I think it's likely that there's an abundance of different species visiting this planet. That's why the powers that be want to keep this so hushed up, because it's bigger than just meeting, oh, well, there's one species of friendly aliens that live a few light years away, and they want to trade alien fruit with us in exchange for bananas. So, you know, if that was all it was to the whole phenomena, that there's some nice little friendly aliens that want to basically trade fruit with us, then this wouldn't be as big of a deal. But you have the huge technological implications. You have the reality of the abduction phenomena. Then you have the reality the whole universe is teeming with life. It's not just introducing humanity to one species, but a crowded universe with all types of life. You know, and not all the life forms look like us. Some of them are not even physical. Some of them are pure consciousness-based. Some of them are energy-based. Some of them could be plasma-based, you know. So it's a huge, it's opening humanity up to a broad new reality. And they just want to be in total absolute control over it. And they don't want to hand over what they know and their evidence and control over it to the elected officials that have the right to control it.
What's your opinion on, well, I mean, obviously the senators have been briefed, like we've had like some relatively mild things going through Congress. Do you think that that's going to start happening more? Do you think we're going to see more of that in the coming years with the quote unquote disclosure, the kind of thing we've described already as potentially being slightly misinformative? Do you think that they're going to see rumblings through Congress?
Well, first of all, we know certain senators and congressmen, the heads of certain defense committees, appropriation committees, were given a briefing by the Navy about the UFO encounters. You know, the Nimitz incident, the sightings off the East Coast, the so-called Gimbal UFO, and apparently they were shown a series of videos, additional videos we have not seen. And apparently they were shown the full resolution, full-length version of the videos, not the little snippets that we've seen. However, I tremendously doubt they were briefed on the special access programs that have been managing this topic for 80 years. I tremendously doubt they were told anything about crash recoveries. The powers that be do not want this information going to the government, going to elected officials. At most, I suspect, I don't know this for certain, that these senators were told, you know what, these are anomalous vehicles and we're investigating and we'll get back to you. That's probably all they were told. And so what we need to happen, and we still have to talk about the Admiral Thomas Wilson document in a few minutes.
We'll get to it if you've got time.
I got plenty of time. But what we really need are for people in Congress, people in the Senate, people in powerful positions to hold congressional hearings. And they have to be open. They can't be secret. They can't be behind closed doors. They need to have open congressional hearings and have all these insiders, General William McCaslin. That was one of Tom DeLonge's original insiders that we're going to be talking about later on, too. And all the people that have worked in these special access programs, you know, people like Robert F. Weiss of Lockheed. He was the executive vice president and general manager of Skunk Works, also known as their advanced development programs for Lockheed Martin. He needs to be brought to testify. We need a ton of insiders out there to be brought to testify to get at the truth of this and share it with the whole world. And it's going to take bold action by the Congress and Senate for them to get access to what they have deserved and had the right to know about all along.
Do you think we can expect bold action from them?
Here's the thing. We have to have hope. We cannot give up.
Right.
If we give up, I believe our civilization is doomed long term. If we keep persevering, we keep pushing, we focus on the crash recoveries. We don't need to focus on the day-to-day UFO sightings people have. Yes, they're fun to talk about. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with watching the videos of the new UFO sightings that are constantly emerging. But the crash recoveries exposing the reality that they took place. That is what will end the cover-up once and for all. That is exposing really that in the Flux Liner, these reverse engineered craft, are the crown jewels of the UFO cover-up. That's what they don't want to be revealed. And if we can expose that, then the whole cover-up will come crumbling. And I'm not saying that likely, but we have to try. We have to attempt this, or otherwise I see a very bleak future ahead.
Do you think that crash retrievals were a transitory phenomena, or do you think that's something that still occurs?
That's an excellent question. The first crash recovery, and Eric Davis mentioned this, was in 1941. I believe it was in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. There was a crash recovery. And then apparently, if you do the research, there's allegedly crashes before Roswell. And then there was the Roswell crash, which was absolutely 100% an extraterrestrial spacecraft. No, it was not a weather balloon. No, the most experienced officers in the military who were at the only base that had access, to nuclear weapons, they would not have mistook a pile of weather balloon junk, basically aluminum foil, balsa wood, tape and glue, for an alien spacecraft, for UFO. They would not have mistook that, because they saw crashed weather balloons all the time. There's no way that was a weather balloon. We have many witnesses who have given affidavits that there was a craft. There were bodies. There were all kinds of mysterious materials that couldn't be bent, that couldn't be burned, that had the ability to have like memory, the whole memory metal where you would ball it up and it would return to its original shape. There was all kind of anomalies. Yeah. It was not a weather balloon. Then we had Aztec that took place in 1948, which was not talked about for a very long time. However, it was indeed talked about in the book by Scully, Behind the Flying Saucers. It was mentioned in basically the first UFO book ever written, but it was fiercely denied. The powers that be tried to deny it. They attacked the idea. They attacked the author ruthlessly. And for so long, it was considered basically to be a hoax or not enough proof for it. But then in recent times, there was a pair of researchers that they spent about $500,000, I think either $400,000 or $500,000 out of their own pocket to research the Aztec UFO crash. I don't recall their names off the top of my head, but a quick search for the Aztec, I believe it was Ramsey was their last name. And they wrote a great book. They've actually have two books about it now. One is an updated version. I believe the last name is Ramsey. I want to say Scott Ramsey. I'm not 100% sure. But they found witnesses that were there that saw the craft, and they got to them while they were on their deathbed. So they got deathbed confessions. They were able to verify aspects of the book Behind the Flying Saucers. They were able to find the high-powered radar stations in the desert that when they were filing Freedom of Information Act requests, at first it was denied they were ever there, because apparently these radar stations were tracking the UFO, but officially they did not exist. But they actually went out into the desert and found the buildings where these radar stations were at to protect Los Alamos and to protect the facilities in that region of the Southwest. So it was potentially these high-powered radar systems that interfered with the navigational systems of these UFOs, and that makes sense. I was going to say these self-organizing plasmas can be manipulated by electromagnetic radiation. So yeah, it's plausible that if you had a powerful radar beam pointed at a UFO that was utilizing, a plasma-based propulsion system, it could interfere with it. So they were basically able to confirm Aztec. And then after Aztec, there were many other potential UFO crashes. But to answer your question, we don't know if they have continued to present day.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm trying to figure what the most recent publicly aware crash is. Do you know?
Trying to think of the name
of it. Because I have no idea.
I read so much in my head about this. I mean, I have so much information in the back of my brain that I cannot bring into my RAM, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, don't worry about it too much. It was just a curiosity. I might look into that.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a number of alleged ones. Of course, I believe Roswell and Aztec are the two that have the most evidence.
Yeah. Well, Greer said that, I mean, if you wanted to go with what Stephen Greer had said, he believes that radar system was a scalar, like, longitudinal weapon.
I don't necessarily believe it was intentionally designed to be a scalar longitudinal weapon. I don't want to get into the deep physics now, but in some of these high-powered systems, there can be longitudinal components to the waves they emit. But that gets really deep. That's beyond the scope of our discussion tonight. But there's reason to believe they could have interfered with these UFO propulsion systems. But those two are the cases that have the most evidence. But we have insiders, multiple insiders, that have admitted there was a long string of crash recoveries. And you have to realize, and this is one thing I want to stress too, and I know we're dwelling on crash recoveries for a long time. One crash recovery is literally a treasure trove of knowledge. Because just imagine, let's take one alien body, for example. That's not just one organism. You and me have thousands of different organisms inside of us. Right now, you may not realize it, you probably have hundreds of strains of bacteria inside of you. You also have a virome. You literally have, you know, countless viruses throughout your system. You also have parasites. You may not know it, but we all have parasites to some degree in our bodies. And so we have tons of organisms. So from one alien body, they could have hundreds or thousands of extraterrestrial organisms to analyze for decades.
Well, this gets into the conversation of biomedicine you know, the idea that perhaps our pharmaceuticals, our idea of cancer research, our ideas behind longevity of life, these things may be drastically different in the Black Projects.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if in some of these they were experimenting with, you know, advanced healing technologies. However, of course, mostly they deal with defense systems. Mm-hmm. So I tend to think it hasn't been their focus, but there's direct application when it comes to UFO technology to physical health.
Do you think Big Pharma have a hand in the UFO portfolio at all?
I don't want to say one way or the other. I have not investigated that to a
huge extent. No, me neither.
About their actual involvement, I will say that there's a big connection between the EVO phenomena and potential aspects of our own physiology. And so that's something the Black Projects may have explored. But to get back about one UFO crash, one single UFO crash, so you have all of this, you know, hundreds of life forms from one body. Then from one craft, you have materials to study. Then you probably have 100 different technological devices. You have circuit boards. You have the propulsion system. You have probably data recording systems. You know, you have every little handheld gizmo probably has 100 just imagine all the technologies out in the cell phone. That's probably next right now. The screen, the circuit chips, the battery, the connectors, the camera, the sensors, the gyroscope.
Fiber optics.
Yeah, the fiber optics, everything. One crash is worth trillions, technologically speaking, but they had a series of them. People underestimate the value of these crashes. It's literally like, imagine, because I'm a science fiction buff, imagine having the Star Trek Enterprise crash. And you could have access to all the technologies of Star Trek. That's basically what this is like. It's that they had it over and over and over again. So they had the equivalent of not only, and I hate to get into this, but I guess I will since I'm a geek, Federation technology, Klingon technology, Cardassian technology, Ferengi technology, all basically dropped in their laps. And so people need to realize they're hiding literal treasure from humanity.
Is it not maybe a little bit dangerous? I mean, you know, we look at it, we look at the perspective of potentially ETs in kind of retrospect to where we are as an evolutionary species. It's kind of the same as like dropping a handgun into a baby's crib.
Well, here's the problem. This is my viewpoint. My viewpoint is a little different on that. You see, I think human beings, human civilization on this planet did things backwards compared to most civilization. Mm. I could be wrong. I'm just guessing here. I think most civilizations start off with the self-organizing plasma. Once they reach a certain level of industrialization and start looking into science, I think most civilizations probably look at nature. They see something like ball lightning. They see other related phenomena, and they start developing these safe technologies, like what the Sapphire Project is doing. And they start studying these self-organizing plasmas, and they use that to develop clean technologies. Maybe some of these civilizations didn't get stuck using fossil fuels for as long as we did. But we got it backwards. Before we developed any of these self-organizing plasma technologies, well, there were people working on these technologies, but they never entered the mainstream, really. They were either suppressed or whatnot. But we developed the nuclear weapons first. And we actually used them on members of our own species. And now, 70 years later, we're just beginning to get these clean energy technologies that are at the heart of UFO technology into the mainstream. So I would say it's not the UFO technology that's so dangerous. It's the nuclear weaponry that we detonated in the 40s, which I believe sent a signal out, because a nuclear detonation sends a powerful longitudinal wave out in all directions, which can have superluminal components. I believe that sent a signal out to the whole universe. So the aliens that were not already visiting your planet, everybody knew about us. And
it go on.
And so they started visiting us to investigate, and I bet they're looking at us and they're face palming because we did everything's backwards. We developed the most dangerous weapons first instead of developing the safe, clean, beneficial technologies, you know, these macro EVOs or self-organizing plasmas. We're doing it all backwards, and that's what probably freaks them out.
Well, it seems like it seems the major difference is separation versus unification, right? In terms of the science, in terms of the physics, because all of our technologies are about explosion, or, you know, a breaking apart, a separation of materials to create energy. And the unification perhaps is, it's almost symbolic, right? Because it does almost seem to be, it seems to be represent of the society that you have. We use only kind of explosive, destructive, separation requiring technologies, and our society is very separate, it's very destructive. And with these unification technologies that require a tapping into maybe the zero point field or something like this, it seems to also provide that species, that civilization, with the technological and energy foundation on which they can start becoming a more peaceful civilization. So, I mean, yeah, it does seem like we've taken the route of all the destructive technology, and that this technology that is about unification in science, quite literally through particles, is also about unification of the species.
Oh, I tend to agree with you there. I really do. I think that when you copy nature, when you look at how nature does something and you mimic it, that's the path to pursue. what we did, I think, with nuclear weapons is we looked at the most destructive edge cases. We looked at all these little side branches that nature usually doesn't follow. There's been papers written that perhaps in ancient Earth history, occasionally, very rarely, there could have been a natural conventional nuclear reactor, you know, like in the Earth somewhere, you know, from various highly enriched ore, you know, let's say uranium ore that just happened to get together in close proximity with enough density and pressure and heat that it developed a nuclear reaction or something. But that's edge cases. But we ended up investigating those pathways that can become very, very destructive and dangerous instead of the ordinary pathways of self-organization that's present in nature all around us, that's present in ball lightning, that's present in the atmosphere, that's present throughout the universe. You can see it. And so we got things backwards. So I agree with you. And I think that humanity was given a gift with these crash recoveries of technologies that could be unifying rather than outright destructive.
Right, exactly. And so when it, to kind of, let's give us a little bit of a segue here in regards to crash recoveries, in regards to United States government's black projects and the type of issues relating to oversight, the fact that the US government on a whole isn't really aware of what's going on, the most notable leak of this type of evidence that would kind of promote this is the Admiral Wilson leaks. And I think most people who are researchers or at least avid, you know, kind of participants of the UFO community are already aware of these leaks. Do you want to give your perspective on them?
In regards to the Admiral Thomas Wilson leak, I actually have a lot to say because I've spent a lot of time researching and digging into that document. I was aware of it ever since Grant Cameron started hinting about it many, many months before it was eventually leaked out. I basically, to talk about it, the document that leaked out, which there's different names for it, Eric W. Davis Notes, or it's called the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, whatever you want to call it. Basically, it's the notes from a 2002 meeting between Dr. Hal Puthoff's chief scientist, Eric W. Davis, and Admiral Thomas Wilson in Wilson's staff car in the parking lot of the EG&G Special Products building at Las Vegas. And he meets with Admiral Wilson. And basically, Admiral Wilson tells him a story. And basically, the story goes that in 1997, to start off with, Dr. Stephen Greer of the Disclosure Project, now he's branched into other projects and other programs, he went to the Pentagon to give a briefing to Admiral Wilson. And Dr. Edgar Mitchell and others went with him. And he told Admiral Wilson that they were black programs, unacknowledged special access programs that had crashed at terrestrial craft and had successfully reverse engineered this alien technology. And at first, Admiral Wilson didn't believe it, but he got very, very interested. He got very curious and he said, you know what? I'm going to investigate this. And he ended up calling various individuals he knew. For example, the former Secretary of Defense, Rick Perry, he contacted a number of different individuals, and they told him where to look in the filing system of the Special Access Program Oversight Committee. And so he started looking in these documents, and they basically guided his insiders, guided him to find the information where there were programs that were being used as covers for these UFO programs. And we don't know what the cover programs actually were, but just making something up here, let's say it was a hypersonic vehicle program, but in reality, it was a UFO reverse engineering program. And so he located them and he started making calls. And he called like 8 different project managers for these special access programs. And he eventually narrowed it down to three or four different special access programs that were working on UFOs. And he called them and they were very mad at him. They're like, why are you calling us? Why do you want to know? Who did you talk to about this? How did you find us? You're not supposed to know about this, so on and so forth. And he demanded access to the project because Admiral Thomas Wilson was on the staff of the Joint Chiefs. That means that he would prepare intelligence documents for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. And he obviously thought, which is correct, that the Joint Chief of Staffs deserve to have this information, because if alien beings are flying in our skies, if we've captured the craft and we reverse engineered the craft, well, the leaders of the military have a right to know. And since he was on their staff, since he was the head of their intelligence division, the intelligence directorate, that he had a right to know too. But they told him that they would look into it. Well, they called him back and said, we want you to fly out and meet with us to their facility. We don't know what facility that was. It was probably somewhere out west, but we don't know that for a fact. So he flew out to meet them. He goes into their building, their secure facility. And the first thing they do is try to find out how he found out about them. But he didn't tell them about some of his sources, like former members of the senior review group, not the current ones at the time, but the former senior review group. He didn't tell them about all the people that led him to them. But they demanded that he tell them. And so he eventually just got frustrated and he started demanding for access, that he wanted to be read in to these UFO special access programs. They deny it. They say he doesn't have a right to know. And eventually he says, you know what? I'm going to go back into the Pentagon and I'm going to demand it. And they said, do what you have to do. But he pressed them harder. And they actually admitted, okay, we do have a crash recovery program. There have been crashes. You know, they basically give him just the very bare bones. And we have a craft, and this is the key, because this is in the Admiral Wilson document. We have a craft not made by human hands, not made on this earth. And so that makes him even more upset. But they also told him this is a lie. I'm 100% sure this was a flat out lie. They told him that they had no success with reverse engineering. They made up an excuse that it was difficult to get the people they needed because of the tight security. It complicated everything, blah, blah, blah. But it was an excuse, because if they had told him the truth that they had successfully reverse engineered a UFO and had anti-gravity vehicles, he would have never dropped it. He would have never let the issue go. So they had to lie to him, because otherwise he would blab to everybody. They'd already decided not to read him in, so there was no point in admitting to successful reverse engineering when they would have known that would have set him off on a mission to tell the world. So they just made up a story that they had no success, they were having all these problems, blah, 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 and it was all a lie. But anyway, he goes back to the Pentagon, and he goes to the senior review group of the Special Access Program Oversight Committee. And this is the tight-knit small group that basically controls the money, and it's the oversight committee for all these special access programs. They're supposed to be able to make all the decision making for funding, for starting programs, for ending programs, what they're working on, so on and so forth. And he goes to them and says, hey, look, you have these programs that are not honestly reporting to you. They are hiding out behind other programs. They are, this is runaway out of control secrecy, blah, blah, blah. And they basically, and he demands access to the programs, and they deny it, but they say, you know, we'll get back to you. So he has a second meeting with them. And at the second meeting, not only do they deny him access again, but they tell him, if you don't drop this, if you do not drop this, we will, quote, take away your pension. We will make sure you don't get your promotion. And you're probably going to lose a couple stars. And basically, he did what they said, and he dropped it, because obviously he cared about his career, and he didn't want to lose his pension, and he didn't want a reduction in rank, and he may have been truly fearful of what they might do. So he was quiet until 2002, when he told this story to Eric Davis, and Eric Davis composed this document, which... it's not quite a transcription, but it's extremely detailed notes about what transpired and what Admiral Wilson said and the information that he discovered. And it was only recently that this document leaked out, although certain individuals like Richard Dolan had been shown a couple pages of this document in the 2000s. So researchers knew this existed, but only a select few researchers had even been shown this document. And this document, what's important to say is this document came from the private files or archives of the late Edgar Mitchell. And Edgar Mitchell had been a member of NIDS, the National Institute for Discovery Science, ran by Robert Bigelow. So it makes perfect sense that because he was a science advisor to NIDS, he would have been given this document. And those people who have been researching this in depth know for a fact this is a legitimate document. It's 100% authentic, mm-hmm. and it comes from the archives of Edgar Mitchell, and hopefully in the next several months, even more proof of its authenticity will be coming out.
Yeah, I was going to say this. It's, I think this is still relatively speculative in regards to who specifically leaked it from his cache of files. Although there have been a couple of people I know of that have claimed that they do know who that is.
Well, what we don't know, a certain gentleman, okay, the chain of custody sort of goes like this. Edgar Mitchell died, and his family members were not going to preserve his UFO archive, all his documents, his papers, his files, his books about UFOs. It was not going to be preserved. They didn't apparently have an interest in it. So a friend of the family, which we do not know his identity, obtained a cache of documents. He asked if he could have them, and the family said, sure, they were not interested in them. They gave those documents, that individual gave this Admiral Thomas Wilson document to James Rigney. And James Rigney was a friend of this person. And then James Rigney showed it to Grant Cameron. And Grant Cameron was supposed to publish it, but he got fearful because of the extreme significance of this document, which is the best piece of UFO evidence the UFO community has received probably in decades, if not ever. And so he got very fearful, but he was quietly distributing it to a few parties. And apparently one of these parties leaked it out onto the internet, perhaps because Grant Cameron was taking so much time before releasing it. And we do not know who it was exactly that leaked it onto the internet. But we do know that it was most likely one of the so-called young guns of ufology. It was most likely one of them. And Grant Cameron claims that he is pretty sure who leaked it. But he has not revealed the identity of that person.
Do you think it's likely that we're going to find out either the identity of that person or the identity of the person who gave it to James Rigney initially?
I think in time it's very possible. There's people doing research on this document, the whole history of it, the chain of custody. So in time, I think it's probable we're going to learn a lot more about the chain of custody. I think that already the evidence that this document is authentic is beyond dispute for anyone who is being reasonable. I mean, for goodness sakes, no one in To the Stars Academy or had previously worked for NIDS has refuted this document. Basically, when this document first leaked, Putoff, Kit Green, several other people gave very carefully worded non-denials about
yeah.
Basically, denials written in such a way that they were so awkward, they were so convoluted. It was basically to say, yeah, this document is real, but I'm writing this strange answer so I can technically say I denied it.
I think in the recent 2020 transitions talk by Halpoff, because there's a Q&A at the end, and he does address it, and he goes a little bit further than what he said in his previous kind of comment.
He actually goes a lot further because you know, we have to be honest, he was exhausted. It was a long presentation, and it was near the end of the question and answer session. And he's extremely brilliant. He's a great scientist. He has a sharp mind, but anybody would be exhausted after a talk of that length. And he let this slip. Basically, he made the statement. He made an important admission. He said something along the lines of, "And my former chief scientist, Eric Davis, interviewed Admiral Wilson." And so he admits, although he didn't mean to, he did not intend to, he let it slip, that yes, indeed, Eric Davis did interview Admiral Wilson. And basically, that's what everyone, all the insiders within TTSA and NIDS have been basically confirming with their weird statements and non-denials about this. They're basically trying to say, yeah, it happened, but, you know, we can't talk about it. Behind the scenes, I've heard that, you know, some of these people have indeed confirmed the Admiral Thomas Wilson document is indeed real, but they don't want to go on the record publicly saying that because all these individuals within TTSA are deathly scared of offending the special access programs. They have this strange, almost obscene loyalty to them. Because I believe what it comes down to is they hope one day to get access to these programs. And they probably feel that if they step on their toes, they may not get access. But the truth is, I doubt they ever will get access because these special access programs are not going to open up unless they are absolutely forced to open up.
There was a comment, I can't remember when it was made, by Eric Davis, but he was speaking about Black Projects, and he was saying, to his knowledge at least, that there is a kind of a shift in opinion in wanting to move away from doing Black Projects, mainly just because the level of budget expenditure on security and compartmentalization alone, let alone the actual research and development of the core subject, but just the security protocols surrounding it, are so obscenely expensive that it's actually becoming just counterintuitive to be doing this for this amount of time. And I can't remember when he said it, but he was speaking quite quickly on it, and he did say that, you know, there was this move away shift in terms of wanting to move away from these types of things.
Okay, well, here's the thing. Ever since the 80s, and beyond the 80s, there has been a move in general when it comes to special access programs. Because just remember, there are tons of more or less conventional special access programs and unacknowledged special access programs that are not UFO related. But there were tons of them, and the Pentagon was spending a fortune on them, and the secrecy was growing to obscene levels. And so there was a move to reform the whole way that these programs are managed, and also a move to try to reduce the number of special access programs. because there were so many. Sometimes this has actually happened. There were duplicate special access programs working on the same thing, but one program didn't know what the other was doing. So there was a move to reduce and get a hold of these special access programs, but you have to realize the UFO special access programs is its own thing. They're treated differently than all the others, okay? And they are like giving these UFO special access programs have been around so long in one form or another, they are given whatever they want without question, period. And we know that from the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, because the senior review group was covering for them. They were allowing them to hide out behind other programs in the official paperwork. And that is completely illegal, because all the special access programs and sub programs have to report honestly to the oversight committee. These were not. They were committing illegal acts by not officially being in the paperwork, like all special access programs, even unacknowledged and carve outs, are supposed to report honestly to their oversight mechanism. They were not. So they were letting them get away with that. They're treated differently. And the only interface at all with the Department of Defense, just to leech money. That's the only reason they do. But to get back to the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, because I really want to get a little more focused on it. What's interesting is if you do your research on the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, there's a lot of names given. And I will not go through all of them because that would take a long time. But some of the names that are not mentioned in the Admiral Thomas Wilson document, but should be, I want to give out. And all this information is commonly available on the internet if you dig. This is all from declassified public documents that are online. You just have to look for them. For example, it was the senior review group that threatened Admiral Thomas Wilson with a reduction in rank, loss of his pension, losing stars, and so forth. Now, according to my research, the chairman of the senior review group is usually the undersecretary of defense or the deputy undersecretary of defense. Well, at that point in 1997, Noel Longmeyer Jr., his last name is Longmeyer. So Noel Longmeyer Jr., he was both the undersecretary of defense and the deputy undersecretary of defense. The reason he held both positions is because he was only actually serving as the acting undersecretary of defense because it was a transition period. But he held both positions. So technically, I mean, there's the possibility that they did not give him this position, but he should have been the chairman of the senior review group. And if he was, that's very interesting, because Admiral Thomas Wilson said it was the chairman of the senior review group who threatened him with a reduction of rank and so forth. So it's very possible that we know the name of the chairman, Noel Longmeyer Jr. Are we absolutely 100% certain that he was the chairman at the time? Technically, he should have been, but it's possible he wasn't. He has actually been questioned, and he actually responded by Billy Cox, and he denied all knowledge of this. He gave kind of a fairly ridiculous denial, in my opinion. But he is a very elderly gentleman. His memory of those days may have faded, so we have to give him a little bit of the benefit of the doubt. However, we also know the name of the director of special programs at the time, who would have been the vice chair of the senior review group. And you have to realize the director of special programs is that position is extremely important because he wears multiple hats. Not only is he on the senior review group, but he's also the head of the Special Access Program Coordination Office. And he holds a couple other positions, too. And basically, the whole black world, all these special access programs go through him personally before they go to the overall senior review group. OK. So he is the nexus. He's the focal point Okay, if you could imagine focusing all the information about the black world with a magnifying glass into one bright spot, you know, like when you were a kid, you probably played with a magnifying glass. If instead of magnifying light, you were focusing all the information that was information instead of light, it would have all been focused on him because he was the gateway between the black corporate right. world and the DOD. And so we know the name of the director of special programs. He was William F. Moore. General William F. Moore was his name. We also know who would have been the executive secretary of the senior review group at the time. That would have been Richard F. Williams. So Richard F. Williams, also known in a couple of documents online, he also went by Mr. Dick Williams. He would have been the executive secretary. And he also served, I believe, as the deputy director of the Special Access Program Coordination Office, which would have been directed by the director of special programs, William F. Moore. So we have these three people now, Noel Longmire Jr., William F. Moore, and Richard F. Williams, who would have been the leadership team of the senior review group at the time. And if there were ever congressional hearings to get to the bottom of this, all these three people are alive. All these three people are alive. And if we had congressional hearings about UFOs, they could call for these individuals to testify. And I believe these are three key individuals that Congress should get in contact with. So I wanted to share that with you.
Thank you very much for sharing that.
Also, I want to mention another important point to make is that General William McCaslin was one of Tom DeLonge's original so-called insiders.
Mm-hmm.
He just called William McCaslin by the general is what he referred to him by. And he talked about him on Coast to Coast AM, and General William McCaslin told him all kinds of things. And you can listen to it on old episodes of Coast to Coast AM. But what's so interesting about William McCaslin is not that he worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. That's what everybody likes to talk about William McCaslin, even in the promotional material for TTSA. Oh, he worked at Wright-Patterson. That's not what's important. This was after the period of Admiral Thomas Wilson searching for these programs. So it wasn't during that time, but it was later. General William McCaslin served as the director of special programs for the Office of the Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Technology. This would have put him on the same senior review group that previously had denied Admiral Thomas Wilson knowledge. So General William McCaslin was an extremely important man. Tom DeLonge had a habit of saying, oh, he's such an important man. No, he is an uber important man. He sat at the nexus of this interface between the black world and the DOD. He was the most important person when it came to managing these special access programs. And so people need to realize when Tom DeLonge was told all this stuff about crash recoveries, Roswell really happening, a string of crash recoveries, successful reverse engineering, William McCaslin would have known. Also, Robert F. Weiss. I mentioned him before. He was another of Tom DeLonge's original insiders. He was the executive vice president and general manager of Skunk Works, also known as the Advanced Development Programs, for Lockheed Martin. And he was one of Tom DeLonge's original insiders. He met him at Area 51. Tom DeLonge has described that encounter at Area 51 with these corporate executives, and Robert F. Weiss was one of them. You know, and so these individuals that Tom DeLonge met with would have information about this topic. And I think Congress, if we ever have congressional hearings, they need to be summoned and asked about all these topics. I mean, we need an all-out effort by our congressmen and senators. We need a bold move to have open, transparent congressional hearings where the whole world watches and all of these individuals are questioned, because all of this needs to come to the surface. It's desperately important for the future of our civilization, for this cover-up to be exposed, for the truth embargo to be brought to an end, so that our civilization can start progressing with the knowledge that has been obtained from these crash recoveries, instead of continuing on blind and ignorant like we are now.
Well, I think that is the perfect place to finish this off. After just almost 3 hours, this has been going now. And that was a fascinating end to this absolutely fascinating conversation.
No problem. But I would just like to leave you with this and your listeners to this. I firmly believe that the number one reason the UFO cover-up is in place is not because they're trying to prevent the public from panicking. It's not because they are trying to stop people from being terrified at the truth. It's because of their desire to protect their bottom line financially and to conceal the technology from the world. And I think what's so unique about the Sapphire Project is that they are beginning on their own to develop technology that overlaps with UFO technology. And they didn't get it from reverse engineering. They basically just looked at history and started experimenting. And this is perhaps the key to helping overturn the UFO cover-up, because if humanity starts developing some of these technologies anyway, it might add an extra motivation for a few of the good guys in these special access programs, because there have to be some people in them that realize it's time for them to come clean. And if we're developing some of these technologies on our own, maybe that will entice them to spill the beans. So I guess that's what I'll leave you with.
I agree completely. And thank you so much for this. It's been an absolutely amazing conversation. I think everyone's going to really enjoy listening to this.
All righty. Well, thank you so much for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.